Good morning. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I'd like to thank Burmester Master Mayan for inviting me to say a few words at this time, this auspicious time. Within this past week, Master Jiyu arrived on this property with a handful of monks. I don't know whether there were any lay people in the group. The property was purchased in the name of the Zen Mission Society, which, to make a long story short, was an outgrowth of the foreign guest apartment in Sojiji. And it was a non-profit at that time, incorporated in 1970 earlier. And eventually the Zen Mission Society was dissolved, and Shasta Abbey as a corporation, as a non-profit, was established in 1976, and the name of the corporation has changed somewhat over time. It's also always had Shasta Abbey in the name, but the secondary descriptors have changed. And in 1983, the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives was created as an umbrella organization, of which Shasta Abbey was one of the temples under that umbrella, along with temples that have that had evolved at the same time since the early 70s. Throstlehole Abbey in Northumberland, and a couple of dozen smaller, typically one monk temples in North America and Europe. So 50 years ago, this phase of Shasta Abbey was put into motion. And I've had the opportunity, privilege, and good fortune of being here for about 49 of those years. When I composed this talk originally, I thought to say, I've had the pleasure of being here for 49 years. But that didn't seem quite right, because it wasn't always pleasurable. As I see it, a monastery is not a place where one goes to enjoy a quiet spiritual life. If you're called to find something greater than yourself, or have a deeper understanding of life than you have to let go of what you think you are, what you know, to make room for becoming and knowing something new and hopefully better. So our practice, if done properly, is a voluntary dismantling of ourselves that sometimes cuts quite close to the bone. In fact, if done thoroughly, it cuts completely through the bone, revealing the blood and marrow of the Buddhas and ancestors. And if one hangs in there during the process, you're profoundly grateful for it after the fact, but not necessarily when you are going through it, because we cling to some aspects of ourselves, such as our views, opinions, judgments, and the like, that are hard to let go of when they're challenged, as they inevitably are and inevitably must be. Not because anyone is running around deliberately challenging us, deliberately figuring out how to annoy people, how to get under their skin, but because that's what life does. And the process is heightened by living with others. Coming to mind is our rock tumbler era, where if you've ever tumbled rocks, at least as we did it, you had these little plastic barrels on rollers, and you'd put in your rough gemstone and a bunch of grit, and you just let them roll and grind together day after day after day. And in the end, what would come out would be a polished gemstone. I think we did amethyst, most of all, at least according to my memory. And the commitment to follow through on our process is the commitment to not to try to get out of that tumbler, but to let it do its work. And if you view things positively, you can turn people who rub you the wrong way, like rocks getting rubbed, you can turn that to your benefit. Both you and they can come out as polished gems when the process is done. Not that it is ever done, because we never get rid of the self, and the self is what gets irritated, or what always has the potential for getting irritated. And this process is true for anyone practicing, although monastic life does it particularly well. It's kind of designed for it. If you take up the challenge of not being run by your opinions, fears, etc., then there will be times when you will be challenged to let go of something that is a core element of what you think defines you. But you can't truly become a new being unless you're willing to let go of the old one, which means there may be times of doubt or darkness, but out of this dark soil, something new can grow. You, and I put you in quotes, can become the universe, but you have to be willing to give up the universe first, down to the last tiny grain of sand. Like many, I came here when I was young, 21, and I just turned 70. And I think, how did that happen? How did that happen? Well, it happened one day at a time. One day flowed into the next, very similar to the next, or the one that preceded it, or the one that followed. Typically, there weren't any dramatic changes, although there were peaks and trough moments. And that's how life generally goes. On the whole, the process has an element of continuity. And we don't particularly notice life passing us by, although something is changing. Something very important is changing in an important way. We're a bit like the proverbial frog in the hot water that starts off cold and the frog's quite happy. And if the water is heated slowly, according to the proverb, they don't notice and end up being boiled. Apparently that's not true. At some point the frog says, yikes, I'm getting out of here. But there's the gradualness that we don't notice is the point. And at some point, as we get older, we notice our own mortality closer to us than the beginning of this life. And we might say, yikes, what about that? Our life has a beginning point and an end point, just as an hourglass has a finite amount of sand in it. Once turned over, the sand continues to run to the bottom, regardless of whether or not we're watching it or thinking about it. Similarly, our time of living is also finite and moves from beginning to end as it must without pause. At some point, we realize that there's not there's a lot more sand in the bottom of our hourglass than in the top, the meaning of which impresses itself upon us since we know the inevitable is just drawing closer inexorably. Now, the human condition isn't quite like this, in that, unlike an hourglass, we can't see how much sand is in the top half, or what we started with. We like to assume it's as started off as full as possible, which gives us a rough gauge as to how long, you know, it will take to run out. But we don't really know, do we? We don't know when the sand will run out. We don't know how much we had in the beginning to begin with. And we don't know, we can't predict an unexpected accident which may smash the glass to pieces. Hence the line in the scripture, "O sincere trainees, do not waste time." And why there is the teaching of impermanence, why there is the teaching of seeing things as they are, that all things rise and pass. To possess the attributes of a human being is a rare gift, but to fulfill our human spiritual potential does not come as easy. Therefore, there's the need to not waste time if we aspire to realize that potential. I mentioned continuity. Each day is a small advancement from the day before and builds on it, often unnoticeably, which is not to say that little has happened here over the years, over the one day at a time, for a lot has happened. Much more than a new person can appreciate who comes through the gate the first time now. They're just having a clue, you know. All the tens of thousands of human hours that have gone into evolving things to the point that we have now. And as far as the human beings are concerned, we've seen the full range of experience of from agonizing suffering to glorifying ecstasy and everything in between. And for those married to this life, the phrase, "for better or worse," comes to mind. But even if one isn't a monk, if you practice long enough, at some point you become married to the way, regardless of your external circumstances. The deeper you go, the more you see that which you cannot unsee, and that which you cannot turn your back on without creating some degree of conflict or sadness within yourself. The physical changes here have been many. The buildings are very different than when I first came. For those who don't know what the layout of the monastery is, imagine two football fields or football pitches side by side. Imagine that area with about 18 or so buildings scattered around the edge. That was roughly the nature of the property some 50 years ago. And there was a piece of land about that size north of the center portion and about that size south of the center portion. And I remember turning up in the summer of 71 and we were dismantling some stone cottages that were on one edge of the property right near the freeway. Part of the purchase of the property was contingent upon our tearing those buildings down because of the freeway right-of-way. So that's what we were doing when I got here. That was the primary work. And we had an old car, an old truck called the Blunderbuss. And you've probably never seen it, but for those of you who can remember the show, The Real McCoys, it was right out of The Real McCoys. It was one of the old, really round, old pickup trucks. And the cottages, we'd tie a rope around the truck and a rope around the wall and, you know, just pull the stone stone walls down. Now, this was after numbering the stones that were around windows, because we figured those were fitted very, you know, nicely and professionally, and we wanted, if we wanted to use them in that way, we had to keep track of them. So each stone around the windows had numbers, and if, I don't know if we ever paid attention to that, but if you ever see a stone wall around here that is one of the stones has A14 on it for no apparent reason, that's why. So it was hard work. We had our traditional 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock tea with River Master Jiu. But it was hard work, and it was exhausting for me. It seemed like after a couple hours, I could barely, you know, hold a screwdriver in my hand. And after 2 weeks of that, I said, well, this is for me. But we paid rent at that time, so because there was no money, so I had to go back east and work during the winter to make enough money. I think we paid something like $60 a month rent just to help pay the bills, because it wasn't much money. The treasurer would often make up shortfalls out of their own pocket. And monks sometimes had to go out to work. One job I had, along with a couple other monks, was working at a local newspaper in the middle of the night, pulling off the press and labeling it, sticking it through some infernal label machine that didn't work half the time. And I remember one time, the press, which was a huge offset press with giant rolls of paper, sometimes it would break down, and the pressman would lose it. You know, he'd lose it. And before I saw that happen, I saw him as just a normal person, just like me. You know, just kind of mellow, you know, took things in stride. And I thought, well, gosh, here I am bashing my head against the wall in a monastery. And, you know, do I really need to do that? This guy, you know, seems to have it together. But it wasn't until I saw how, because of my meditation practice, I would have handled the incident differently. Hopefully, you know. By not losing it, not going ballistic, but by saying, okay, this is what we have, what do we do next? I don't know that the group that turned up in that November 50 years ago knew quite what they were in for when it came to winters. There's picture in one of the early journals that I saw. That's how I found out about the Abbey, from a religion professor who, you know, said, well, I know about this place if you want to go somewhere. And it's a picture of a monk sitting next to a wall of snow. It was staged, you know, we didn't sit in the snow. It was kind of a stage photo to show how much there was. But it was kind of a wake-up call for the fact that there were serious winters. So the thought was to connect all the buildings that I just described with the covered walkway, the cloister. But we didn't have any wood. So we started buying up condemned houses in the small town of Mount Shasta, a few miles away, for a dollar. The fire chief wanted to get rid of them, so we'd buy them for a dollar. Send in a load of, you know, enthusiastic people in a big truck, and in a matter of days, tear that house down. People in town would be driving along the street, and they'd say, "Wasn't there a house there yesterday?" You know, and we'd bring all the wood back, all the plumbing, all the pipes, all the sinks and bathtubs and nails, which we straightened. We didn't buy nails. We had endless work periods of hammering nails. The hammer heads were welded onto pieces of pipe. not proper hammer handles. You know, we just made do with what we had, starting pretty much from scratch. So our buildings were not fancy. I can remember looking at that a strip of wood that was maybe 8 feet long, and it had a nail every 3 or 4 inches, and over half of them were driven in halfway and then bent over. And, you know, that's about as far from fine Japanese temple craftsmanship as you can get. But again, we were working with old nails that we straightened as best we could. The wood was old and hard. And if I think and look below the surface, I can know the people that were doing that, the people who were enthusiastic, innocent, had beginner's mind, and were just working on themselves by doing what they were asked to do. That inner work. And that's what we were really doing. Building the temple, the physical temple, was secondary. The real temple was the people training there. That's the most important thing, not the buildings. And Throssell had a similar, evolution. They started with a modest amount of small buildings and built from there. It's quite impressive when you look at what they did. And we did most of ours in the sunny summer, and they did a lot of theirs in the rain, which makes it even more impressive. Our first big temple bell was a water tank that was about 3 feet across, 5-6 feet high, and we cut the bottom off and we hung it from a rope and hit it with a log, and it made a mighty thunk. It wasn't a nice ringing sound that they would hope for. We've had visits from some old monks from Japan on occasion. At one point, one of them saw that bell and said, just like Dogen, in the early days when he started from nothing, I don't know whether it was the same monk or not, but one of these old monks, when they saw our meditation hall, their heart was warmed because they saw a meditation hall that just reminded them of, the temple meditation halls in Sojiji, at least. I don't know about Eheiji. And as I understand it, he sort of wanted to hang out in the meditation hall for a bit. We built the meditation hall according to Master Ji's directions. None of us had been to at least I had never been to a big ceremony hall, meditation hall in a big temple. So we made platforms as described, and little wooden accents that describes railings, to keep you from falling off the side, I guess. And it's been interesting to now that you have YouTube, you can see old films of monks in Sojiji, doing their ceremonies, or shots of the meditation hall. And I say, look, it's just like ours. These little funny wooden decorative accents are just like they have. Of course, we copied them. But it's just interesting to see how much River Master Jiu remembered from the relatively short time she was there. It's kind of staggering when you think of all that she remembered, all the fine points of practice, all that went into, what we call our priest book that described how all our various ceremonies are done. It's really remarkable. We've had various eras throughout the years. We had a dog era where there were, I don't know, it seemed like there were almost more dogs than people. Every house had a dog, you know, for protection. And we had a goat era where we had a goat herd of, I don't know, at least 25 goats. We had a homemade donut night era, which was great for everyone except the kitchen who had to make homemade donuts. I think it was a Thursday, I'm not sure. But, you know, donuts are not easy to make. It's messy, you know, and it's hot, and you have vats of oil. But we did that for a while. I mostly saw things happening around me and didn't necessarily know why things were coming into existence or fading out of existence, but I suspect there was a cry from the kitchen that, you know, it's just too much, you know, it's just too much. And sometimes things are determined by the amount of people you can put on a project, like the goats or the garden. You know, we had a garden era where there was much more activity in the garden. I won't mention the pinworm era, just so that the then sacristan or not the then infirmarian won't, burst into tears or have a panic attack. Fortunately, that was a very short-lived era, but it's part of our history. We had an open house and bake sale era. We had a monk who was very good at making fine pastries, which were not the norm, you know, for the Mount Shasta area. So it seemed like it would set off kind of a local feeding frenzy when it was known that we, you know, were having our bake sale, which, you know, I sometimes wondered about, you know, the wisdom of that, you know. But we did that, you know, for a few years. We had a infamous yard sale that people still ask us about. They still ask us about the bake sales, you know, just in the hopes that we might do another one, but it's been many years since we did one of those. You know, starting from scratch, we tended to save whatever came our way, such as all the stuff from the houses we tore down. And River Master Jiu, having gone through the war, was very frugal and saw uses in everything. You know, I think I've picked some of that up. When I see a paperclip, I see four little lengths of rebar that you can use for a glue job, you know. But at some point, we had just so much stuff. In our bone, what we called the boneyard, which was just up in the manzanita bushes, that we thought, well, we just have to kind of get rid of some of the stuff. So we hauled it all out and, you know, had this gigantic yard sale. The people would come, they'd look and see what we had, look at the prices, and run away and come back with trucks, you know, to, you know, buy anything, get a sofa free, you know, that kind of thing. And that was another sort of buying frenzy. We only did one of those. I think that's the only yard sale that I can remember. We have the eternal construction era, which started in the beginning and still continues, although that's tapered off quite a bit, and now it shifted more into maintenance of that which we constructed to begin with, because, you know, once we finished most of it, we had to go back because it was, you know, things deteriorate. You know, we have to fix what's falling apart or what the snow collapses. And when I think about not the buildings, not the physical structure, but all the people that came through here, the monks and laities who were there through these times, there's not one of whom I do not think kindly about and only wish the best for, regardless of whether they are still here, in contact or not, or have clearly gone in another direction. If you came through our gates and stayed for just one day or for years, thank you. If you genuinely sat for one day with us, if you saw that you have the ability and the choice to simply see what arises in your mind, thoughts, perceptions, emotions, etc., and see that you don't have to go any further than just simply seeing all that, then your physical, mental, and emotional well-being is so much more in your own hands than if you don't realize that you can just see that stuff. You don't have to act on it. And you aren't so lost and entangled in them that it's hard to discern between that which calls for action, wise action, and that which can just be let go. I'm grateful to whatever anyone contributed, whether you're here now or not. Because however we evolved over the years, it was because of the efforts of many. Guided by the wisdom we gained over the years and by River Master Jiu's focus on what she called keeping true to the source, which she repeatedly pulled us back towards during her lifetime. Especially when we became as if professional builders or cooks or professional artists in our own minds, rather than monks or dedicated lay practitioners. Now, I won't define here what keeping true to the source is, other than to say that our meditation practice, the letting go aspect of that practice, is what opens the door to religion and the road to religious truth being something other than an intellectual exercise, something other than the understanding of concepts. It opens the door to becoming what the concepts are all about, what they're pointing to. A line in the scripture says, and going on beyond this human mind, he is nirvana, not he understands nirvana. It's a matter of being, not understanding in the worldly sense. Experiential understanding comes first. Then it is expressed with words as concepts. But the way to the experiential understanding is not through the understanding of the concepts, which are at best an inadequate and misleading description of a state of being. A state that is more fundamental to our overall being than anything the world knows as knowledge or understanding. Our approach is primarily through the meditative practice of letting go, and less through study, although as intellectual beings, study does have its place. But ours is primarily, and the core of our study is through our meditation. Now, the word meditation, you encounter it a lot. And it's a bit like the word exercise. If I were to say, I'm going to exercise, you wouldn't know what I was going to do exactly, because there are all sorts of exercises. You might know probably what I'm not going to do. I won't be lying on a couch with my feet up, eating bonbons and reading movie magazines. Now that phrase, eating bonbons and reading movie magazines, is kind of an anachronistic kind of code phrase that I have with a friend when we want to talk about whether we're goofing off or not, you know. So you'd guess I wasn't doing that. I'd be doing something a little more strenuous at least, but you wouldn't know exactly what I'd be doing. I'd be doing exercise. And if someone says they meditate, I don't know exactly what they're doing, because I know there are so many different forms of meditation. But you'd have a sense that they're doing something with their minds that's deliberate, probably with some sort of focus or control, and that is probably different than what we do with our minds when we just go about, you know, our day-to-day business. But you wouldn't know, again, exactly what they were doing. From my experience and observation, to me, the word meditation covers a wide range of practices, which for now I'll group into three types. At one extreme of this range, you have deliberate thinking, focused thinking with a purpose. There's an intellectual content that you're deliberately working with. In Christian meditations and some Christian monastic strains, this form of meditation might be thinking of the qualities of the saints and comparing them with yourself to see where you might be able to do better. A Buddhist form of this sort of thinking, discursive meditation, might be sitting in front of a funeral pyre and reflecting on one's own impermanence that is seen in the person who has died, and doing so for the purpose of motivating ourselves to get on with our practice. In any case, this sort of meditation requires that we let go of irrelevant thoughts in order to bring ourselves back and maintain a focus on what we're thinking about. And that gives the mind some practice in doing just that, getting used to letting go of things that are extraneous, of thoughts that aren't relevant to what we're actually doing. Another category, wide category of meditation forms, do not involve working with the intellect and ideas and concepts. These might include counting the breath, reciting a mantra, where you don't think about these things. There's more a simple repetitive action. And when the mind wanders away, you bring it back to the counting or reciting. Letting go, again, of extraneous thoughts. But not having anything intellectually for the mind to do. And that gets the mind used to being without constant reference to and reliance on the intellect. It exposes ourselves to just being in that place where we aren't constantly using the intellect and relying on the quality of our being through the intellect. A third category might be called themeless meditation, where we don't deliberately think about anything and we're not doing something repetitive with the mind. We're letting go of the mind and its contents completely, letting go of deliberate doing and gently and non-judgmentally doing that over and over again. Again, in Christian monasticism, they have their corresponding meditation to this. They start off with, and I can't speak in any authoritative way about Christian monasticism, nor can I speak about Buddhist monasticism in any sort of authoritative way. I'm just speaking from my own experience. But in certain Christian traditions, they start off with thinking, as I just described, thinking of the saints' qualities or thinking of all sorts of things with a purpose, and that has some intellectual content and purpose for smartening us up. Then they might move on to something that's repetitive and less of an intellectual exercise. But eventually, for some, they come to a sort of end of the road with this and have to leave the known behind because something in them is still not satisfied. They abandon themselves to the unknown. At least that's how the intellect imagines it. And they take up what they call, and I'm referring to the practice as described by St. John of the Cross, they take up the practice of contemplation. So they move from the practice of meditation, deliberate thinking or repetitive practice, to just more of a practice of pure, what we call letting go, and they call it contemplation, which in thinking about it makes sense that we are the order of Buddhist contemplatives because we've taken that Western term, which is essentially letting go, and incorporated that into our name. It's the Western term, or a Western term, that describes our meditation, or is comparable to our meditation. And speaking of St. John of the Cross, we had a St. John of the Cross era here. It wasn't all that long. I don't remember much about it. I mainly remember some quotes that stuck with me, which I sometimes pull out because they really hit the spot. And one has to do with how he described to adherents how to meditate. I find many of the things he says resonate well with our practice, although our roads have many similarities, but I wouldn't go as far as to, you know, say, well, we're doing exactly the same thing. But what he says about contemplation is the following, and I've tweaked it a little to make it a little less sectarian, a little more universal, but I didn't tweak it much, just a word or two. But he writes, as often as distinct ideas, forms, and images occur to us, we should immediately, without resting in them, let them go and sit in emptiness of everything rememberable. And it's this in emptiness of everything rememberable that kind of strikes me as trying to describe something that is otherwise very hard to describe. Because what? Everything's rememberable. You know, so you sit in emptiness of everything. It's reminiscent of phrases that you encounter when people are trying to describe Zazen or Shikantaza in particular, such as think the unthinkable or think non-thinking. Ours is don't try to think and don't try not to think, which is a little less puzzling to me, at least, than think the unthinkable. But how do you describe not doing, not deliberately doing, without turning it into some form of doing? How do you do not doing? You know, how do you talk about it? How do you describe letting go of letting go? And just allowing the universe to be as it is, without our breaking it into bits and naming it all, without our creating a distinction, which is a gulf between ourselves and the rest of the universe. However, the idea of letting go is not one to be in interpreted simplistically. It's not an encouragement or permission to withdraw from life or from responsibilities that life presents us. Instead of letting go, I sometimes prefer to say, just stop clinging or stop grasping after things. If you stop clinging to something, if you open your hand, it falls to the ground. It's still there. It's not disappeared, but you can pick it up and use it as you need it. You're in charge of it, and you're not stuck to it. It's not in charge of you. Letting go can be misconstrued as a need to get rid of, to cut off, to get rid of your positions, sever your relationships, which that is not the intention at all. It's more nuanced than that. It's more sophisticated than that. To quote St. John of the Cross again, in terms of the thoughts and feelings and that which arises in the mind, he says, again to aspirants, they should not think or look on these things for longer than is sufficient for the understanding and fulfillment of their obligations, if they refer to this. At the appropriate time, they should consider these ideas without becoming attached or seeking gratification in them, lest the effects of them be left in the heart. Thus, people are not required to stop recalling and thinking about what they must do and know. For if they are not attached to the possession of these thoughts, they will not be harmed. So he's saying you don't have to become an inhuman person that has no thoughts or feelings, no humanity. It has more to do with the relationship that you have with these things, rather than whether they exist or not. It's more complex than just a black and white things. You know, sometimes people talk about, don't want to have a television because it's a worldly thing. Television's a television. It's just sitting there. It's how we use it that turns things into worldly things or not. And that's what we do. We change the relationship we have to the things within us and around us. We don't get rid of them. We don't have to, and we can't. You can't stop your thoughts. You could very easily, You just whack yourself in the head over, with the hammer, and there you go. What good is that, It's more refined than that. It's changing their relationship we have with thoughts, with things of existence. And part of that is changing our understanding of what we are, what it is that has the relationship with things of existence. Now, the Abbey is still here because people carried on, living one moment at a time that flowed into the next moment, that flowed into the next moment, which added up to days, weeks, months, years, and decades. And this carrying on echoes the continuous quality of our practice, the carrying on quality of our practice, the acceptance of which leads to the resolution of a paradox which one encounters when reading the words of religion but not actually doing the practice. This particular paradox is reflected in Dogen's Rules for Meditation. It was his koan, if you like. If we're enlightened from the first, why do we have to train so hard? We have similar phrases, such as, the wheel of the Dharma lacks for nothing, yet needs something. The mirror never had any dust upon it from the beginning. But we need to clean it for a while as if it did have dust on it in order to realize that. The goal of goallessness. Again, these things that, you know, don't quite, first half just doesn't quite match the second half. There's a conundrum there, a puzzle to harmonize. You know, how do you harmonize? We're enlightened from the first and we train. You know, how do you harmonize those two narrow concepts? Dogen's answer was that training and enlightenment are one and the same. They aren't different. But he found the reality of his answer from the inside, not by convincing himself intellectually that it was true. The intellectual answer doesn't really resolve the conundrum presented in the words. And speaking of words and their limitations, this points out the problem of teaching with words, which cause the arising of concepts which are inevitably narrow in meaning compared to the whole big picture, and inevitably conflict with other narrow concepts. No one concept can encompass the whole. So the question is how to encourage others without stirring up goal-oriented behavior, without stirring up spiritual grasping. Quite frankly, I'd rather you forget everything I say and just walk when you walk. See, not look, when you see. There's a difference between simply seeing and looking. Hear, not listen, when you hear. There's a difference, a subtle but important difference between hearing and listening. Don't sit with the aim of finding a different state of mind. And if you can do that, you make it more likely you eventually experience the underlying quality of your so-called ordinary state of mind. You'll see that that is the very mind of Buddha. In the ordination ceremony, we say, even though you do not yet know your enlightenment, you are already the real child of Buddha. And that pertains to everyone, not just monks. You may be familiar with the practice of alchemy, practiced by ancient sages, where the idea put forth is that they're trying to transmute base metal into gold. Well, I think if they were sages, they probably had better things to do than trying to figure out how to turn everything into gold. To me, I wonder if that's what's really happening, is they're transmitting something that seems quite ordinary, our ordinary mind, transmuting it into the Buddha mind. It's changed. It's not changed from one thing to the to another. It's transmuted. We see it for what it really is, what it has been all along. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's what alchemy is really about. The deeper aspect has been lost in its code. You know, as I understand it, there are certain times when Buddhist practice has had to go underground, and the code was used to express things which you just couldn't express plainly in public. In formal meditation, we can practice letting go, non-clinging, non-grasping, with minimal external distractions. but we should aspire to carry this attitude into the complexity of daily life, with which we have to engage unless we live in a cave, which is probably not free of its own problems. And doing this in daily life, beyond just formal sitting, is so important. It's as if there's a stool with, it's a third leg of a stool. Formal sitting is a leg. Sitting, active, moving meditation, living life, following the precepts, is a second leg, and faith is a third leg. Faith that this practice of meditation, as simple as it sounds, has great benefit if one just keeps doing it, keeps naively doing it. So it's one thing to sit on your cushion, and it's another thing to practice that sense of non-attachment, not getting caught by your views and your opinions. It's one thing to catch yourself in daily life. We all have views. That's part of being human. We all have opinions. And we have to use them. But if we practice in pure meditation, letting them go, because they're not relevant, you're just sitting there looking at a wall as we do, then we aren't so pulled around by them when they arise, and we have to figure out which ones are worth paying attention to and which ones can just be let go of, you know, in daily life. If you don't do that, you gain a little ground when you sit, and then you just kind of undo it by not keeping up the sense of non-clinging, non-grasping. How meditation works, I don't know in the way that I can know how a clock works by opening it up and, you know, seeing all what gears hit, what levers, that sort of thing. But it clearly does change us over time if we keep at it. And the depth of change is dependent on how honest we are with ourselves and how deep our wish to change is. How willing are we to leave behind no part of us in this process? At one point, River Master Jiyu's ordination master, Kim Seng, came from Malaysia to visit us. He visited us once. And he had a private interview with most of the monks, one at a time. I'm not sure it was all of us, but I think that was his intention. And I remember him explaining the meaning of various things to me. The meaning of the things on the altar, the flowers, the water, the incense. And he said the incense, the smoke of the incense rises up and it goes everywhere. It goes under doors. It gets into closed drawers. It just gets everywhere. And that's what you have. Nothing is hidden from it. And that's what you have to do in your practice, is not leave anything hidden away. Don't think that little things don't matter. As St. John would say, and this is my last quote from St. John of the Cross, it makes little difference whether a bird is tied by a delicate thread or by a heavy rope. For even if it is tied by a thread, until the thread be broken, the bird cannot fly. So don't underestimate the little things. Now, if you're like me, you know how human you are, and you may think, I've got a lot of threads, you know. I don't know I'll ever be able to rend them all. Well, I'd say, don't worry. Don't create hurdles for yourself that actually aren't there. Trust the practice and just keep going. The universe seems to have a built-in grace factor whereby it seems to me perfection is not required. What matters most is the quality of the wish in your heart to do the best you can, even if we all fall short in actualizing that wish. Sometimes you read about teachers who give a deathbed teaching. Well, I plan on being around for a while, so, you know, I'm not thinking I will have to be giving that. But just in case I get hit by a bus later on today, I'll leave you with what I would want it to say. And that is, you have all you need within you. If you don't see it, don't worry. Or if you don't see it as completely as you would like to, don't worry. Don't look outside of yourself. Don't judge yourself. Accept your humanity and just keep going. Just carry on. Trust the practice. And finally, I'd like to express my gratitude to Reverend Master Jiu for arriving here 50 years ago and for her example of carrying on in the midst of conditions. Conditions which ranged from the sublime to at times the ridiculous. Thank you, Reverend Master. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.